This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Ann Moss Joyner and Ellen Parnell are married, live in a farmhouse in Mebane, and they work out of a little place near the house, used to be a church. What they do is a little hard to describe. Basically, they make maps. Their maps are actually several images overlaid to form a single picture, a picture that is often a portrait of discrimination. They use geographic information systems, or GIS, along with detailed census data and other information, to generate maps that can illustrate pretty clear civil rights violations involving whole communities. Their work has helped win court cases in several states. They've also convinced town councils to open water and sewer access, and they've succeeded in winning annexation for underserved communities. Ann Moss Joyner and Ellen Parnell join me in the studio now. Also with us, Mark Dorison, who has worked with the Cedar Grove Institute. That's the name of their organization, Cedar Grove Institute here in North Carolina. Mark is Senior Managing Attorney at the UNC Center for Civil Rights at UNC School of Law. And I want to welcome all of you to the program. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Nice to be here.
So, Ann and Ellen, let's talk about one of the cases to give us a sense of what it is you do. It provided some technical assistance. One of these cases involved water access for the Coal Run neighborhood in Ohio. Tell us, where's Coal Run and what was the case all about?
Coal Run is a small African-American neighborhood just outside of Zanesville, Ohio. There are not many African-American people in Muskegon County, Ohio. They're concentrated largely in this neighborhood. When Muskegon County and Zanesville ran the water lines in the mid-1950s, the water line literally stopped at the last white house. And these people couldn't use well water like you'd think because the groundwater is contaminated from coal mining. So since the mid-50s, they were catching rain off of their roof to go into cisterns or driving to the water plant a mile away and filling up barrels and bringing them back and dumping them into their cisterns. So their neighbors had a hot tub, and they could barely wash their clothes.
And to give us an idea, because we think of an unincorporated area of a county just outside the city limits, talk about the density or give us some sense. I mean, these weren't isolated, one house here, one house there.
No, it was a clear neighborhood. They were relatively small lots, certainly three-quarters of an acre lots.
All right. And had they asked then since the 1950s to get water?
They'd asked several times. And in 2002, a county commissioner told them their great-grandchildren's grandchildren would never get water.
Oh.
They were told that they would get water when one of Bush's bombs drilled down through their land.
All right. So this is all happening. It sounds darned illegal to me. Let's start there. Is it illegal to deny that water? It's an unincorporated area. Zanesville is not the county. So they say, sorry, folks, you got to talk to the county.
Well, Relman and Dane, the attorneys, filed this case, and they took Fair Housing Act claims. I'm not an attorney. Mark could address some of the legal stuff, but they were...
Well, tell us about that, Mark.
Well, in the Zanesville case, the claim was brought as a fair housing claim that the denial of water and sewer was created discrimination in the housing and in the ability to use and enjoy the housing. In the Zanesville case, what Alan didn't mention is that they ran water lines well beyond the city limits all around this community. And so it wasn't as if providing water and sewer to the Coal Run neighborhood would have set a precedent or been a deviation from what had been their standard practice. And so the attorneys were able to demonstrate, and a jury agreed, that the decision to deny access to water and sewer to this community was based on race.
We're able to demonstrate. Enter Cedar Grove Institute for Sustainable Communities. What did you do and how were you a part of this case?
I was the second witness in a six-week trial, and what Relman and Dane had me do was build a map showing exactly house by house the race of the members of each household by whether or not they had water.
And now this seems like a pretty simple process, really. Did you? Because we're talking about the technology here, but all of this stuff should be on maps and in charts and in records in the county records.
Much of it was public data. Almost everything was public data. We had public GIS files showing where the water lines ran. We had addresses of who had billed water service. What we didn't have was the race of each member of each household. Census data don't give you house by house data. So I designed a short little survey, and two paralegals from Relman and Dane went door to door so we could get the house, the racial composition of each house.
And tell us about the GIS connection here. We'll Well, we'll connect the dots.
Well, the GIS, geographic information systems, allows us to build maps by having layers at a time. So this is, and in front of the juror, we began with a simple layer, just showing the neighborhood, and adding a layer at a time. So we built the whole picture up to the conclusion, showing exactly who had water by race from the 1950s on.
And again, to point this out or to underscore what you're saying, there were communities well beyond this area, this neighborhood, that were getting water unincorporated.
Oh, that,
the pipes were going all around the neighborhood.
The water ran 12 miles beyond this neighborhood.
So tell us a little bit about the origins of Cedar Grove and how you got started. What got you into this?
Well, we live outside of Mebane, North Carolina, and one of the CDCs representing a community development corporation, representing some black neighborhoods outside of Mebane, was fighting a bypass and had been trying to get sewer for a fairly dense minority community that was contiguous to Mebane, but didn't have sewer and had some failing septic problems and other issues. And they called the Caroline Population Center, and Alan was sort of the resident local. And
Token local.
Because they do a lot of international work. And so they put them together. And when they were taking a look at what was going on, he and I were talking about it. And I used to be a land developer. So I said, oh, well, you know, this is what they're doing and this is how they're doing it, since I knew the rules. And we just kind of got involved from there. And it just went on.
It took a life of its own.
And what were you doing at the time?
I'm a demographer. So I had an NIH-funded grant at the Carolina Population Center at UNC Chapel Hill.
So it's not just turning on the GPS. When the information comes out, you actually know what to do with it.
Right.
That helps.
We hope.
Well, then what you have to do is turn it over to a lawyer like Mark. So tell us how this information is any better than you just going to the jury and saying, look, 30 miles away they're getting water, 8 miles away they're not. They're black there, they're white out. I mean, couldn't you have done that? And how much more compelling is this evidence?
Well, it's tremendously more compelling. That what the work of Cedar Grove has helped show, really graphically illustrate, and in a way that is impossible to deny, is the phenomenon of municipal exclusion, or what demographers call underbounding. And that's the process by which, you know, low-wealth minority communities have been intentionally underdeveloped and excluded from municipal boundaries. It has its legacy in the history of legalized residential segregation. But the pattern has been repeated and reinforced as towns have grown and expanded. And so what the work of the Cedar Grove Institute has done is been able to create these maps and statistics and really visual images of how towns have grown over time and have grown either past or around, and in some cases completely around, like a donut hole, low-wealth minority communities. And so when you have that evidence presented in that stark visual form, it becomes compelling even for folks who either are unaware that that development has taken place or are unaware of the history. And so that information has been invaluable in the work we've done at the Center for Civil Rights and working with some excluded communities in Moore County, not on a litigation model like was done in Zanesville, but on a community engagement model where community activists and organizations took information from Cedar Grove and with the center's assistance and went to the town councils and said, look at this inequity, help us.
So that's interesting. So to some extent, I mean, somebody has to know what they're doing. This cannot happen entirely unintentionally. But there could be a vast swath of the community, of the white community, that, you know, isn't engaged in this, so they don't know what's going on.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You drive around and you don't see every time there's a boundary change. There's no sign usually saying, you know, city limits, because they change frequently. Towns are no longer coherent geographically. The whole definition of what is a community has changed. In North Carolina, you have to have a cost-benefit analysis to annex an area. You don't have to have that kind of analysis for a sports complex. You don't have to have it for the arts. But if you want to take in a historic community that's been there for, in some cases, centuries and been allowed to, you know, basically fall apart, you have to do a cost analysis. So it's a big detriment.
Anita Earls, used to be at the Center for Civil Rights, the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, labeled this invisible fences. We had the Center for Civil Rights at a conference in 2004 beginning to address this issue, and that's exactly what we have. Until we map it, it's not, the relationship with race isn't clear.
I just want to say that invisible fences is a lot better than underbounding. technical term. I think a geographer came up with that. So no more.
Yeah, he did. A geographer at the University of Tennessee.
Yeah. So the fine arts people do the naming, and the geographers do the mapping. Let's do that from now on. But Mark, let's talk about you talked about Moore County and annexation. Tell us what's going on there, because I know you're working with Cedar Grove on a problem right there.
Well, the center's been working with three communities in Moore County that are, two of them are now. Have been annexed, which is a great victory for the people. But three communities that when we got engaged with were on the fringes of municipalities in that area. Jackson Hamlet, which is outside of Pinehurst, Midway, which was outside of Aberdeen, and the Wayna Road community, which was outside of Southern Pines. In all three of those communities, the center, working with the community leaders, really raised the issue of the exclusion and the lack of access to water and sewer with the respective town officials. And in each case, the town, with the community's prodding, agreed to seek community development block grant funding to extend water and sewer into these communities. And that was a tremendous change and a tremendous improvement in the lives of the residents there. But in all three of those communities, that's only one part of the picture of exclusion, access to services. The other part, and in some ways the most significant one, is the lack of a political voice. And so annexation and literal inclusion in the community has always been a goal. North Carolina law, and as you know, annexation is a hot topic and has been for the last several years, mainly around communities that don't want to be annexed, that are trying to resist annexation. And so to be working with communities who are seeking annexation really changed the debate for a lot of folks, including legislators. The current state statutes, however, impose very significant restrictions on when a city can initiate annexation. There has to be a certain amount of density. The community, the area has to be developed to a certain extent. And in these historically excluded communities, they've been traditionally underdeveloped. They don't have the population density. They don't have the non-residential uses. And so even if a town wants to annex them, they are unable to under the statute. There's a voluntary annexation process by which the citizens can petition to be annexed. But on that policy, the state statute requires 100% of the property owners to agree. And it also, even if you get that, it doesn't impose any requirements on the city to provide services within a certain time limit. The involuntary annexation has these time limits that cities have to meet. The voluntary one does not. So if you're a community, even if you could get voluntary annexation, there's no guarantee you'll get those services.
Yeah, it could be a long time coming. But there's one other question in this. In the law, as I understand it, maybe you can explain this for me or clarify that not only can I hold you at bay and keep you unincorporated, but I do have some kind of eminent domain, so I can actually put my dump in your backyard, but you can't vote. Am I right?
Well, in a lot of these communities, which exist on the fringes of incorporated municipalities, those excluded communities are subject to the town's extraterritorial jurisdiction.
That's a great phrase.
So in North Carolina, cities can exercise land use, zoning, planning controls beyond their borders. And so many of these communities are subject to the land use regulations of the adjacent city, but without the power to vote for elected officials who make the decisions that really are the most impactful on their lives. And that has been held to be constitutional by courts across the country. I will just say this one other thing. In the 1950s, the General Assembly did a study of extraterritorial jurisdiction and whether it violated due process. And it's clear that in justifying it, the legislators believed it was reasonable because these areas would eventually be annexed and become part of the towns. What we know is that many of these excluded communities have been in the ETJ for decades.
ETJ.
The extraterritorial jurisdiction for decades, and that the towns don't have any intent on annexing them.
Ann?
it's not just that they can put unwanted uses like landfills in these areas. It's also they can change your zoning. And these are primarily residential neighborhoods. So if they change your zoning to commercial or usually industrial manufacturing, your house becomes worthless because nobody, you know, a developer doesn't want any land with houses on it. They want the empty land. And so you've destroyed the equity of that neighborhood, basically.
It seems to me that this is also the extension of the other question we're facing in the state about education, about resegregating schools, not through the law, but by neighborhood. Does what you're doing have any implications for education reform and diversity?
Yeah, I actually did a study 2 years ago of Wayne County schools and showed that the way that they drew their attendance area boundaries for the high schools, at least, was created segregation there where it wasn't necessary to maintain neighborhood schools. And we did that by showing the enrollment versus the actual residential patterns of school-age children, and also by redrawing lines in various cases. And that work was then taken by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and turned into a Title VI complaint with the Justice Department that is going forward now.
Well, that was going to be my next question to you, Mark. What laws are being violated? When you take it to court, what are you using as a legal justification?
Well, again, at the center, we've been very fortunate that we've achieved successes in the communities we've worked with through community engagement. And the town of Aberdeen and the town of Southern Pines were very, when these issues were raised, were very supportive of bringing these communities in. But there are a number of legal issues. I think that the fair housing ones are one of the critical ones. Title VI, which is the federal law that prohibits any recipient of federal funds from discriminating on the basis of race, is another avenue. It's one that has that a lot of people are hoping will be have some life breathed into it again in the new administration. It's one that has been fairly fallow in the past. But the I think also in the school setting, there are questions about whether following segregated residential patterns for school assignments doesn't violate the state constitutional's right to a sound basic education.
Alan, a lot of the information that you use, especially with infrastructure, is or had been available to the public, but that has changed since 9/11.
People don't like us showing this stuff. Mebane, in particular, was so aggravated they passed their own ordinance called the Infrastructure Information Protection Policy to keep the digital water and sewer lines out of the hands of terrorists, namely us. So that we can't show exactly what they're doing. We ran into this in Zanesville as well. They claimed Homeland Security reasons not to show where the water lines ran, that they were not going to this African-American neighborhood. So we're running increasingly into local governments and state agencies trying to hide what is really public information. We hear a lot about open records, but it's usually in terms of meetings. But there's this all of this digital information that's being compiled by governments that we should all have access to as well.
So, Mark, is there a way through the law to make a case for them not being terrorists? Can we do that and say
we're working on that?
Prove it. Can you prove that you're not? So, is the work getting harder to do then? Would you say?
Not in most jurisdictions, but in some. For instance, Pitt County is making their information hard to obtain, not through this manner, but by making it expensive. They want $120 for their road center line data, one layer.
Wow. And well, which raises the question: how do you support yourselves at Cedar Grove?
We've had some grants from foundations. Or work with the attorneys. We had an NIH grant, NIH-funded grant. So it's we're a not-for-profit organization, and we're truly not-for-profit.
You got that part all worked out, huh? Good job. Alan, Ann, and Mark, thank you all for being on the program today.
You're welcome.
Yeah?
Thank you.
I just wanted to point out that the success that we've had in Moore County was primarily due to the Center for Civil Rights. I mean, we pointed out the issues there, but they took the ball and ran with it and really made the change.
Fantastic. Mark Dorison, is the senior managing attorney for UNC Center for Civil Rights at the UNC School of Law. Ann Moss Joyner and Alan Parnell run the Cedar Grove Institute for Sustainable Communities. And for more information about their work, go to cedargroveinst.org. Coming up after a short break, John Shane plays live. Stay with us on The State of Things.
Makes them so crazy. Makes them so sad.